Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
The host of public radio's This American Life will be coming to Chico March 26th to perform in Lexan Auditorium. Ira Glass has restaged his radio interviews as dance pieces and spoke to North State Public Radio's general manager, Beth Lamberson, and me about three acts, two dancers, and one radio host. I'd like to welcome you, Ira Glass, to Nancy's Bookshelf and North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'll be hosting, but we have a treat this afternoon. Our general manager, the station of North State Public Radio, is Beth Lamberson, and she wants to say hello to you, Ira.
Good day to you, Ira Glass. So glad you could join us and talk about what
Hi, you guys. Nice to be here.
I know you get this all the time, but we're all still trying to wrap our head around the dance part, and especially having radio interviews restaged as dance pieces, and then the three of you share your stories as well from the stage.
Yes, yes, all of that. I know it doesn't, it sounds weird. It sounds weird. I know it sounds weird, and I apologize in advance for that fact. Basically, what it is, it's a show where I tell stories and they dance. Sometimes it's just them, sometimes it's just me, and sometimes we mix the two in one piece. And I just saw them perform, and I thought, oh, the thing they're doing feels exactly like what we're trying to do on the radio show. They're really funny. There's a documentary quality to what they're doing and capturing moments of real life, but they are also like entertainers. Like they're super fun to watch. And when I saw them perform, I thought like, oh, if our audience would see them, our audience would be into them because they're doing the same thing. And then we tried to invent a thing to combine what I do and what they do.
I watched the trailer, and you have what looks like just a look of complete joy on your face as the confetti rains down, or perhaps it's a little terror and relief.
There's not a lot of like confetti cannon work in my normal job, it's nice to be in a different context where that can happen.
We plan to employ confetti cannons into our next pledge drive, I can guarantee that.
They add a lot of excitement, I have to say.
Ira, the first time I met you, I really thought of you as a shy person, and yet you went onto television and now you're onto the stage. Are you shy at heart but a performer as well?
It's funny. My older sister Randy has this thing where she says she describes certain people as noisy introverts. And I think that's what I am. I think that I actually feel most comfortable when I'm alone and with nobody around. And yet I seem to have put myself in a lot of situations where I'm on stage. And now I like being on stage. Like I've gotten very used to it. And I think there are a lot of people who write who are like that. I feel like a lot of the writers in our show have that personality. Sarah Val, David Sedaris, I think. I think it's not an uncommon Michael Chabon. It's not an uncommon personality for somebody who decides to do something so solitary as write.
Both Nancy and myself just were writing down noisy introverts on our list. That's a great description. Through you, we're all becoming very familiar with choreographer and director Monica Bill Barnes. That's an extraordinary story of how the two of you first met and what's evolved until now, and I'll invite you to share that with us.
I mean, I first met Monica. We were both doing a show in Brooklyn at a bar that somebody was putting on as a kind of like just a fun thing for 100 people where it was a So You Think You Can Dance knockoff with sort of not very famous people being the celebrities. And so I trained with a choreographer for 6 weeks to do, because I have no aptitude for dance at all, to do a modern dance piece with this choreographer where there's a lot of like lifting her in the air and I don't know. Anyway, and Monica was, who is a professional dancer, was one of the judges, and she was super funny and super smart, and I just really thought she was amazing. And then after that, I saw one of her shows, and like I said, like seeing their shows, I got very excited because I felt like, oh, this feels like our radio show, but the one thing that makes the radio show go, which is words, they don't do the one ingredient that we base the whole show on. And I really like puzzled at it. Like, wait, everything we do, really, if you get down to it, is all words. And everything they do has no words. I mean, I guess we both have music because there's music in the radio show and obviously there's music in the dancing. But I was like, I just thought it would be interesting to work with them. And then I concocted an event to get them in front of our audience where we did one of these cinema events where you put something on stage. We put a show on stage, an episode of our show, and beamed it into movie theaters around the country. And tens of thousands of people came out and saw it. And basically it was an episode of our show, but there was like, you know, dance breaks in it every now and then. And I did that because I thought, like, well, that's the only way that I could get our audience to see them. And they were a huge hit. People would ask me about them afterwards. And then afterwards, we're just like, okay, so can we do something next? And then we started to try to combine what we do into a show. And although it sounds like it's a weird set of things to combine, like there were certain things that just came together very, very naturally. And the dancing, we found it works best if they aren't illustrating what I'm doing. That is, if it isn't like I tell a story about a volcano and then they pretend to be like a hula dance, you know, and then they pretend to like be the volcano lava with their fingers or something. Like, it's not like that at all. Like, what it is like I'll tell a story and then they will tell a kind of parallel story through movement, if that makes sense. And so, for example, one of the pieces that's a very beautiful piece is this interview I did with a former poet laureate, Donald Hall. And it's a story about his wife getting sick and dying. And so I had that. We had put that on the air in the early years of the radio show. And Monica and Anna had a dance that they do where they're dancing, standing on top of a dining room table very slowly with each other, that when we put the two and combine them into a thing with a few adjustments, but really combine these two things, it felt just the two things just went together in this very beautiful way. What they're doing is not illustrating at all. It's just another thing. And so the visuals function the way that music functions on the radio show. They just amplify and intensify the feeling.
Art Glass joins us today on Nancy's Bookshelf, and I'm a guest host here with Nancy Wiegman. I'm Beth Lamberson. This is in advance of the performance on March 26th at Laxon Auditorium in Chico, California. Three acts, two dancers, one radio host. Art Glass joined by Monica Bill Barnes and Anna Bass. Those tickets are available at chicoperformances.com. Ira, creating new and fresh content is your stock and trade, and now you're part of a choreographed, rehearsed, probably try to get it as much the same night after night. How's that transition been?
It's weird. It's really weird. It's like it's funny, until I tried to do it, I wasn't aware of how unusual it is to be on the radio, like that every time you go on the radio, you say something totally different. Except, of course, during the pledge drive when you say the same thing over and over.
Until we air your spots.
Yeah, exactly. But like generally, like, you know, and most performers, like their working lives is doing exactly the same material. And in fact, we even do a story in the dance show that's about this exact thing. But I had never had to perform the same show. Now, I mean, we've been touring the show for 2 years and it keeps going until we end in July in Australia. But I had never performed anything over and over and over. And honestly, like, it's a really weird, I feel like this is the difference between somebody like me who is not like a born performer and the people who I know who are born performers. Like, now I know the dancers very well. And I know some people who are actors and comedians, and they love being on stage. They actually love the experience of like, they really like, they want to get up in front of people. They're excited to do it. Versus I think most of us who are civilians who, like, you know, I feel like I've gotten myself to the point where I enjoy it, but it took me a while to get there. And saying exactly the same thing in every show is really like, I found it's a very zen thing to do, because to do it well, you have to re-feel all the feelings every time. And I really had to learn how to do that. And it's really made me appreciate people, like people who are on Broadway. Like, we did a little Broadway musical as part of a show, and I became friends with one of the performers who was like the star of Wicked for a while, Lindsay Mendez. And she and I have talked about this a lot, about like the weird, you just have to feel everything again. You can't fake it because it doesn't work. It doesn't look right. And so I have learned to do that. And then thankfully we're in a show where there are spots where I can ad lib. And so I definitely take advantage of that so I can say different things. Otherwise it would be hard for me.
A quick radio aside here, your fundraising spots that we've all used are always met with phones ringing, people people saying, yep, that's me, I'm guilty.
Oh, that's very nice.
But we had so much fun with the one where you were the practice guest with Stephen Colbert. And I've been wondering if you've had a shot at going back as a real guest.
I was invited to do a little thing when Sarah Koenig was on Stephen Colbert's show recently, but decided that I didn't want to. So no, I haven't been back. I've been super enjoying his show. I have to say, he is a really interesting interviewer, and more interesting in this show than he was in his old show. Like the variety of moves that he does, just like as a professional interviewer, I have to say, are just incredible. And he's very efficient and both. Gets people to open up, but also is very pointed sometimes with people.
Well, I think the combination of you saw the depth and respect he had with Vice President Joe Biden, and then, of course, the funny
that was amazing. Yeah.
The funny he had with you about public radio being a secret girlfriend, which, thanks to you, we now have that out there on the airwaves. We appreciate it very much.
Yeah.
Ira Glass joins us today. He will be performing at Laxon Auditorium with Monica, Bill Barnes, and Anna Bass in three acts, two dancers, one radio host. Tickets are available at chicoperformances.com. This is the kickoff to the second annual Dance Chico Week. Ira, how does the theater audience contribute to each performance?
I mean, I don't want to say too much about that, but I will say, like, we've had very enthusiastic audiences, and there is one spot in the show where we do pull a couple of people up on stage.
All right. We'll be ready for that.
And I do think, the interesting thing with the audience actually is that I can always feel at the beginning of the show, and sometimes I talk about this from the stage, I can feel that people are just like, what is this going to be? Like, I totally feel that. And then there's one spot in the show, it's funny, I know exactly the spot where people are just like, okay, it's gonna be okay. Like there's a specific point in one of the early stories where I feel like the entire audience, you just feel them relax. I'm like, and then the laughs change and everything changes.
It's not going to be too hard for them. They didn't have to study.
But also, it's a sort of like, I feel like it's not only just not going to be too hard, but just like, oh, it's going to be good, I guess. I guess it's going to be good. like there really is a moment because people really just don't know what it's going to be. And I think one of the things people get, and I know because people have said this, like it's so such a different thing to come see. Like, there's no other show like it at all. Nobody's ever tried this. That the part of the show is learning is learning what to expect and we keep changing up what to expect. So part of the show is just the pleasure of people realizing, like, oh, this is it. This is the show in a really nice way.
Our guest is Ira Glass, and he hosts This American Life here on North State Public Radio. Ira, this is Nancy Wigman again, and I was interested in the fact that I understand that at Brown University, you majored in semiotics. For somebody who relies on words to communicate, I was surprised when you said that what you learned at Brown, you use every day.
Yes.
Could you tell us? Because Chico is a university town. We've got a university. We've got a college. And I wondered, well, what did you learn at Brown that you use every day?
I mean, semiotics is a body of theory, right? And it concerns a number of things. But one of the big things that it's about is narrative and narrative structure. And the thing that was very helpful for me is that there are a lot of really great writers who write about when they write about stories and write about how stories work. They're not interested in the things that like a regular old fashioned literature class would be interested in. They're not interested. They'll take apart a story and they're not interested in the old fashioned what are the themes of the work and what does the author intend and what does it show us about the author's time and all of that. Like, it's they're not interested in any of that. What they're interested in is how does the story give pleasure? And specifically, how does it get its hooks into us? Like, why do we keep turning the pages? Like, why do we want to keep reading? Why do we want to keep watching something on TV? Like, what does it have to do to pull us in and pull us forward? And then at the end of a story, if a story is good, that feeling of that was so good. Like at the end of a great episode of TV or a great movie or a great book. it's what semiotics is interested in is like, well, what produces that feeling? Like, what gives you that feeling? And when that has failed to happen, like, what has failed to happen? Like, what is the difference between like a J.J. Abrams Star Wars and a George Lucas Star Wars? You know, like what produces, you know, like the end of Breaking Bad, that feeling of like, wow, that was really good. Like, what is the machinery that gets you there? And there are certain things about the construction of narrative and the way that you use narrative, and especially the way you raise questions and answer questions, that honestly, like, the entire structure of the radio show is built around, and that I use all the time, even down to the fact that we begin the show with plot. Like, on all the public radio shows that I worked on in the 17 years before I started This American Life, I worked for the Daily News shows, I worked for All Things Considered and Morning Edition, and the great, great radio shows, you know, the best of their kind in the country. And you know, all those shows, they begin with like a little thing at the beginning of the hour where they say, coming up this hour, and they billboard the show. And on our show, we don't do that, because I feel from what I studied in semiotics that for our kind of show, it's way more effective just to start the plot. Because as soon as you start a progression of things happening, this leads to this, you know, this thing happened and that led to this next thing and that led to this next thing, it raises the question of what will happen next, which will keep people listening more effectively than saying in a list, here's what's coming up this hour. If you're our kind of show, because if we were to say the things that are coming up, they would just sound ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's different if you're doing the news. Like, you know, you can say, like, we talked to the vice president. Like, you know, people might stick around for that, you know, like, or whatever. But like, on our show, like, if we say, like, you know, a girl feels bad because, you know, like, I don't even know what thing I wouldn't say to make fun of my own show right now. But, you know, like, if we were to try to describe the stories, they would not sound good. And so it's and also I feel like it's more powerful to pull people in and get them caught up in the dream of the story and just want to find out what happens next. Like, that's activating like just a very deep part of us as people.
In fact, I thought of this very thing when I was looking at stories told by Joel Chandler Harris, and I would read the fable upon which his stories came from, these African folk tales, read about the tar baby, and it was so flat. And just whoever wrote it, just, well, this is the story. And then I would read Joel Chandler Harris's version, and I was caught up in it. And mm-hmm. I saw, boy, what a difference it can make if you know how to tell a story. And I was intrigued with the fact that Dr. Deepak Chopra offers a course. He's teaching a course at Columbia University, and one of the sessions is on storytelling. He invites students to come up to the front of the class and tell about a defining moment in their lives. And I was wondering, well, does he tell them how to go about telling a story? Because when we grew up in school, you've made this point, we're not taught how to tell stories in school. And yet it is so valuable, whatever our profession, whatever we do in our life, we need to be able to tell a story.
Yeah, it's weird that we don't teach it in school.
So if you were to have this class, Dr. Chopra would invite you in, Ira, and say, Ira, teach these students how to tell a story. What other tips? You mentioned some tips on storytelling. What other tips would you offer these? Because these are business students, MBAs, that he's teaching this course to.
Well, when you're telling a story, the most important part is to understand what the plot of the story is and to know the beats of the plot. And when I'm interviewing somebody, that's the thing I'm super aware of, is like, what are the beats of the plot? What's essential? What isn't essential? You know, beyond that, it's kind of all sort of about feeling. Like, what are the parts that get to you most, you know, in the plot? Like, what are the moments that are the most relatable and that they're the most powerful? I mean, I think it's hard to summarize without examples, and diving into examples is the truth. I mean, in our show, the structure of the stories is like, it's literally like one thing leads to the next, leads to the next, leads to the next. And then at some point, somebody has to reflect on what has happened and say something about it. Because I think that's also part of a really great story, not just on the radio, but in life. When we tell each other stories in real life, we don't just give the plot of the story. We say, like, and here's how this made me feel. Here's the thought this leads me to. And then on a story on the radio, obviously the plot, to be good enough to be in front of, you know, 4 million people, the plot has to be surprising. The idea has to be surprising. It's good if there's a funny part. It's good if there's an emotional part. I mean, you know, the standards of like, you know, a story that you're going to play for millions of people are different, obviously.
Well, speaking of Dr. Deepak Chopra, he is somebody who meditates 2 hours a day. And you earlier said that your experience on the stage, what you're doing now, this performance, is a Zen-like experience. And I have the feeling that you're not the kind of person who would be able to sit still and meditate, perhaps like Dr. Chopra, that your mind would be so full of ideas that you would have trouble sitting down to meditate for an hour.
Well, to say ideas really, really, really elevates it higher. It's more just full of worry and anxiety. Like, it's not like I'm having, it's not like I'm Thomas Jefferson or somebody. Like, I'm having like a lot of like, oh, I should have not been so mean to Elise in that phone call. Like, there's a lot of that. Do you know what I mean? Like, was I nice enough to this person? There's that, like, that's most of where my mind goes in any resting moment. Like, when I say the performance is Zen, it's because you just have to enter the moment of being there and standing there and just completely like relive a feeling. It's so weird. It's just weird that people do it for their jobs.
My guest is Ira Glass. He hosts This American Life here on North State Public Radio. And I would like if you would do me a favor and explain the process when you're putting together This American Life, because the process can sometimes take months. And sometimes when I interview a writer and they expect, I think, to be able to get on the air right away, and it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes it does. But how do you go about putting together an episode of This American Life?
Well, some things are fast and some things are slow. It's not unusual for us to put together, you know, a story in a couple of days, but in any given show, usually we'll take 3 or 4 months and we'll look at way more material than ends up on the air, and often go into production on way more material than ends up on the air. And then things will just drop away. Things don't turn out to be good enough. We'll kill easily a third or a half of everything we start. Which makes it very different from, you know, what we would do when I worked on All Things Considered, the morning edition, where, like, when you're working on the news, like, they tell you in the morning, like, okay, you're going to be doing a story, and it's going to happen in the second half hour of the show, and it's going to be 3 minutes and 45 seconds, and it's better show up there, you know, it better be there. Like, it will be there. It will be three minutes and 45 seconds, no matter what. And so it's a very different kind of approach to doing journalism. And more like what a big national magazine would do, where they'll start a lot of things knowing some of them just aren't going to work. And in radio, like, that's even more important because you're so dependent on the people in the stories being good talkers. And often we'll get into a situation where something interesting happens, but the person isn't a great talker. And then that would be a good story to do for print, but you go, like, on the radio, if they can't talk so well, it's not so interesting to hear. And so we'll run at a bunch of things, and some of it takes months, and then some of it will take days. Like, a couple of weeks ago, two or three weeks ago, we did this episode where one of the stories was this huge investigation that we've been working on for months with the New York Times about this guy who got shot in his own hospital room in Houston. And the show ended with a story where one of our producers, Nancy, interviewed this unbelievably wonderful writer, Michael Kinsley. And that was like a 12-minute story that she put together in 3 days. You know, like, she interviewed him, wrote him out of the draft. You know, we did a bunch of drafts of it, or 4 days, you know, from beginning to end. And, you know, that was that. And it was 12 or 15 minutes of airtime. And so in any given show, there'll be a mix of, like, very long-term things and very short things.
Well, Ira, one point I've heard you make is you were contrasting what reporters do, and a reporter can expose wrongdoing, but then nothing happens. And I remember there was a story that you did where it did make a difference.
Yeah, I've been doing journalism since I was 19. I'm 56 years old. I feel like there's one story that I can point to which actually, like, had a concrete effect on something in the world. And it was a story about this judge in a small town in Georgia.
In fact, I don't know if you maybe notice I have an accent, and I happened to be turning the radio, and I thought, Georgia, because I was born in Georgia. And I was especially interested in this story. You went to this county in Georgia to find a story.
Yeah. We had this idea. There was an old column in the Atlanta Journal, before it was the Atlanta Journal Constitution, and it was called the Georgia Rambler, and it had been written by the father-in-law of one of our producers, and this very wonderful journalist named Salter. And he would basically get in his car 3 days a week, 4 days a week, and just, like, pick a town on the map, and go to a small town, and then force himself to find a story there by the end of the day, because he came from a small town in Georgia, and he's just like, well, the city newspaper doesn't really cover the small towns, and he was on a one-man mission. He was a good reporter, and he would find something every day. Every day he'd go out, pretty much. And we thought, well, that seems like a really fun exercise. And so there's, how many counties are there in Georgia? Like 60, 70 counties, something like that. It's crazy, right?
It's a big state.
It's a big state. And then the way that they created the counties, many people explained to me, was you had to be able to drive from one to the next on a horse in a day.
So, I hadn't heard that.
So, yeah, yeah, because it had to do with like the people who have to go from county. Anyway, so we basically literally like put the names of counties in a hat, and I picked this county on the coast. And as soon as I got there, and I have one day to get a story, literally the very first person I talked to mentioned this judge and said, like, you know, and there was a guy who was in a big fight with the judge, and that person told me about it. I was like, oh, maybe that's a story. And then over the course of the day, like, more and more people kept telling me about this judge. I was like, if this stuff is true, like, I just had this feeling of like, oh, like this judge doing some things that just didn't seem right. And I had this feeling of like, oh, if this is true, like a reporter should really look into this. And then I was like, oh, I guess I am a reporter. And then, but proving that what people were saying was true took months, like months. Like I kept going back down. I couldn't get people to go on the record, which is typical when it's a case with the judge. It doesn't, you know, even a good judge, like people wouldn't go on the record against a good judge in a small town. But just to get someone to go on the record, and it really took 5 or 6 months. And honestly, my staff thought I was crazy, and my wife was just like, "Why are you going back there?" I felt like I don't know if this is true, but if it is, somebody should do a story. And it was also had the thing of like it was the town of Brunswick, which is like 15,000 people, and you just feel like, well, what's the universe? Like, what does somebody in California think about? Like, what does somebody in California care about, like a judge in a town that's so small they'll never visit? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like it, but we did it, and it turned out that the kind of thing she was doing, like, it pointed out a really interesting thing. Is she ran a drug court and pointed out some interesting things about the way drug courts work and how they can work badly sometimes, even though generally they're very, very good. These courts that you know give people probation and instead of throwing them in prison, but hers wasn't running the typical way, and after we did the show, she was there was a judicial commission that looked into her and she resigned, and now there's criminal charges against her that she was found guilty of, and she's not a judge anymore.
My guest is Ira Glass. He hosts the popular This American Life here on North State Public Radio. And Ira, I was interested in the fact that you don't seem to have a bucket list as far as your show goes, that the stuff you want to do, you do it. You don't have any dream projects that are sitting that undone.
No. I feel like, and especially since podcasting became a thing, I think public radio listeners, some of them know this, but some of them don't, just kind of what a big deal podcasting is. And honestly, because of podcasting, we suddenly have all the money we could ever use to do investigative stories and to, you know, to spend 4 or 5 months on a story or send, you know, 3 reporters into a high school for 5 months, which we did a couple of years ago, this high school, which had 29 shootings in a year. And, you know, just to send 3 reporters for 5 months anywhere is just a huge, you know, you need a big newsroom usually to be able to do that. But now we can do that because of the money that comes in from podcasting, like the just the little underwriting announcements on the podcast, you know, brought to you by Squarespace or MailChimp or something, makes us enough money that we have the luxury to do anything we want.
So it sounds like your parents eventually forgave you for not going to medical school, Ira.
It took a while. It took a while.
I wonder.
Like seriously, it really took a while. Like our show had been on the air for 5 years before that happened. But yeah, they did.
Well, we're all looking forward to your show when you bring it to Chico to Lexan Auditorium. It's 3 acts, 2 dances, 1 radio host, our beloved Ira Glass. This will be March 26th in Lexan Auditorium. Tickets are available at chicoperformances.com. And Ira, it happens to be Easter weekend, and so I'm wondering if maybe, because you sometimes feel that Christians get a raw deal in the media, but I'll see if you do any adaptations Easter weekend when you are here.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea, actually.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah,
thanks, Ira.
Likewise. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Ira.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll be talking to Chico social worker and community volunteer Robin Engel, who published a story about a lousy date she had years ago and about the failures in her love life that are exposed in her book, Woman on the Verge of Paradise. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is a local social worker and community volunteer who grew up in Southern California. After publishing a story about a lousy date she had years ago, Robin Engel realized that it made people laugh to read about her miserable lack of love life. She has continued to expose her failures in love and sex for readers' amusement in her creative nonfiction book, Woman on the Verge of Paradise, which she describes as an anti-fairy tale story of her life, which includes lots of honesty and scattered pinches of artistic liberty. She calls her book memoir-ish. Robin Engel, welcome.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
Well, I mentioned, of course, you've written this book, but you are also a poet. And
yes.
You have a poem. You only have one poem in this book.
Right.
And I would like for you to read that poem.
Thank you.
Who have you written this poem to?
This poem is for my mom. And she was and still is the heart, my ground, my calm, love of my life in many ways. So
And long after your mother passed away,
you
mentioned your mother throughout your story.
Yes, yes. We lost her when I was 18. Yeah. Kindred spirits, you and I, fragile souls, enduring ties, secrets known, never shared, countless fears, never scared. So much achieved, though never proud. So much lost, though not allowed. My ground, my heart, my love and calm, my kindred spirit, my soul, my mom.
This is my guest, Robin Engel, and her book is Woman on the Verge of Paradise. It is prose, but she is also a poet and a blogger.
Yeah.
And your blog, then, how does your blog relate to your book?
Well, my starting of my blog was also around the time that I realized I'm a writer, and I started running more and more with my dating stories, and I am also a chocoholic, so my blog is called Life by Chocolate. I started it about five and a half years ago, and I'm still avidly blogging at Life by Chocolate. It's a lot of fun.
Well, I mentioned that you grew up in Southern California, and you first made a move when you decided to go to graduate school in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was funny that your friends are saying, oh, Robin, you're going to freeze to death
up
there. And what did you do?
Oh, so I bought a couple sweaters. And I was really tired of hearing that. And I came up, I went up to Oakland and the Berkeley area, and it was the same weather that we had in LA. So that was not an adjustment that I expected.
In fact, in your book, you start listing the things you'll be leaving behind in Southern California.
Yes.
And you say you couldn't pack fast enough.
I could not pack fast enough. And I'm still so glad I'm far from there.
So I don't want to skip over all the adventures in the Bay Area because they're hilarious.
Thank
but
you.
I do want to pick up where you We're thinking, oh, maybe I'll move up to Chico or Paradise. Now, let's see.
Yeah.
Which place should I move to, Chico or Paradise? Would you read, this is in chapter 16 of your book. You started by saying, before making the move, I checked with Emma a handful of times. And you might tell us who Emma is.
Emma is, of course, that's not her real name, but she lives in Paradise. And she's the one person I moved for. I knew nobody. I knew nothing about the area. But I moved to work for Emma. So before making the move, I checked in with Emma a handful of times. During one of these calls, I spoke with her former assistant. Patricia stopped by to visit, Emma said. I thought I'd put you on the phone with her to talk about the job. Sure, great, I replied. Patricia's voice projected confidence and encouragement. You'll learn so much. You'll soak it all up, and it'll be great for your writing. Great, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, I replied. Can you tell me a little about the area, the social scene and all? Like, would you recommend living in Chico or Paradise? I'm trying to decide. Definitely Chico. There's a lot more to do, and it's a younger population, too. But even though there's more to do, we really don't have a shopping mall or... Oh, yes, we do. Don't scare her away, Emma interjected. No, we don't, Patricia corrected Emma. Robin needs to know that there really isn't a shopping mall here. The Chico Mall doesn't count.
And then you say, okay, that's all I need to know. And so you are moving up here for this job. Mm-hmm. And this former assistant whom you are replacing mm-hmm. says, oh, you're going to learn so much.
Yeah.
And let's see if it worked out that way. So when you come up here, then you have to find a place to live.
Right.
And you're checking on possibilities, and you find out about this house to rent. And you said you were told if you're interested, you can bring this application by our place this evening at 6. And you found this house at 5:59 that evening. And what about it?
And then I found myself in a family meeting, mafia style. Sit there, Jason's wife commanded, pointing at a very high stool at the very high kitchen table. Climbing onto it, I was watched by mother, Jason, and son, already seated quietly. We want to answer all of your questions, Sergeant Mother began, but there are lots of people interested in the house. I'm showing it to a family this Friday, and our son might move back in, too. I smiled at the son, who looked about 20. He didn't flinch, maintaining a serious focus on me and his mom. I'll make my decision by Saturday, Sergeant said. I expected some knuckle cracking. Instead, Jason and the guy maintained a stern silence as Sergeant Mother studied my application. So you'll be working for Emma Money, she stated. Yes, that's why I'm moving here. She's heard of Emma. Good sign. I'm publishing my third book now, she nodded, as if she knows all the ins and outs of the publishing business. Uh-huh, so you'll be sending emails and little tasks of that nature. Yes, things like that, I grinned. Come to think of it, I didn't know what I'd be doing. In fact, I didn't know what Emma did. I just wanted to work for a writer, as a writer. Fame and fortune would ensue.
So you're moving up here to work for a writer because you want to be a writer and you want to learn about this. And then it didn't work out.
No. I was already in my 40s and I still harbored this naive fantasy that I would have this fairy tale. 7 weeks later, it fell through and I lost the job.
Only 7 weeks after you pulled up roots from the Bay Area, you've lived there and you come up here and now... You're without a job.
Yeah.
And you do have some better luck. You did find a home in Chico mm-hmm. after this episode with Sergeant Mother. And you discovered that this job isn't quite what you thought it was.
Right.
You met Heidi was nice, and Daryl, but they were fired. Well, fired.
These
other employees
too.
Of Emma's first one and the other disappeared. Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't pay you what you were due, what she said she would pay you.
Right.
And so finally you thought, okay, that I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't a very pleasant ending. Because she said she was going to train you.
Yeah, yeah.
Did she come through with that?
Oh, no. No. And it was devastating. I was up here again with no family, no contacts, moved up for her and the job, and I left the Bay Area, which I loved. But I also knew I wanted to stay and I would make it work. So I did.
So I mentioned that your book is about your anti-fairy tale life.
Right.
With dating all these different guys. And you had tried the dating scene when you lived in the Bay Area. And then you come up to Chico. And how did you go about making contacts when you got to Chico area?
It's happened kind of slowly but surely for me through being involved with a lot of different activities, Jewish organizations, and volunteering through it's called Out of the Darkness, which I am actively volunteering with. And I have generally had an easy time making friends, so I'm fortunate for that. It's difficult as a single woman to have friends to just go out with on the spot. But it's Chico is such a nice place to be. And yeah.
In fact, you mentioned in your book that in February of 2014, Sunset Magazine reported that Chico, California tied with Bend, Oregon as the best U.S. city in which to reboot your life.
Yeah, isn't that awesome? I think that's
great. I didn't
great.
Know that distinction about Chico. Just, it was a good place to, and then of course you go on to play with that concept of rebooting your life.
Yeah.
And so where you're living, you've found this place with a nice cat named Mojo.
Mojo. Mm-hmm.
And you felt quite, and in fact, you say you are lucky to be in Chico, even though I don't have a job that I moved here for. It felt like home right away.
It really did. It's amazing to me. There was no adjustment. It's as if I was meant to be here, and I'm not kind of like a hippy-dippy type who says that kind of thing, but it's just such a good fit for me. My family is here. I feel that my friends, my family is here, and there's some family in Southern California too, but yeah, it's a great place for me. I'm really lucky.
Well, the place you found to live, and I don't know if you still are living in the same place.
No, I'm not. Yeah.
But it was a very nice gentleman. There was no romantic relationship there. But he had one particular trait that you really needed.
I really needed it.
Could Stephen do?
Yeah, I describe it as kind of the ideal marriage. There's no sex or romance, but he was very helpful with computers, and I'm very not informed with computers, so he helped me a lot. He took me to find and purchase, I purchased it, of course, but he took me to shop for a computer and was really helpful, really nice guy. We're in touch through, the internet now, so he moved out of the area.
Well, and you may have been exaggerating because you did take artistic license in your book. But when some of the things you said you didn't know about computers, I was rather surprised, and I don't know how truthful that was, or were you exaggerating a little bit? You knew a little more about computers than your character in the book, did you?
I did get a little creative with that. I do know what a CPU is. Yeah.
So anyway, you have this nice guy named Steven who set you up with your computer. And then through these online contacts, you meet various men. And the ones you describe have something in common. They're nice dads.
They're nice dads. For a while there, I kept attracting single dads. And for a while there, too, it reawakened in me, well, maybe I'll be a mom, and stepmom.
Because you'd love children.
I love children. Children and I have always loved each other and gotten along really well.
In fact, you are Aunt Robin to Joshua.
Auntie Robin to Josiah. Yeah, that's his book name. And we adore each other. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you talked about various, you signed them names. Of course, I know that these aren't the real names because you're here in Chico. You live here.
Yeah.
But you mentioned, for example, a date with a dad named Chris, and you say both dates were platonic, but he kept calling and texting you, and you say things weren't leading anywhere.
Yeah.
This is the bottom, page 302. When did you start? He wants to call you back, and why did he want to? This is page 302.
Oh, when he was going to put his kids down to bed, and he was going to call me back exactly 75 minutes. There was no creativity in most of my dating stories are word for word. He was going to call me back
because
in 75 minutes.
If he's texting you, then you've got the written words right there.
And this was over the phone.
Okay.
And this was several years ago, so it's been more than 75 minutes. I'm still waiting.
So what did he say? He said,
Those were your last words. 75 minutes. Can I call you back in 75 minutes? Yeah. And you said all this time later, he still hasn't called.
No, he still hasn't called back.
Well, the next section, right after you described Dad Chris, you described Dad Bobby. And why don't you read that little section there where Bobby and I exchanged fun emails.
Yeah, sure. Bobby and I exchanged fun emails and made tentative plans for a possible first date. We'd meet at Tea Fusion on Monday evening. I think I can definitely do that, he kind of confirmed. The confluence of events has occurred, Bobby emailed Monday morning. My dog got sprayed by a skunk. Tammy has soccer practice that I forgot about. Family is coming to town Friday and blah, 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 with no apology. This is a life of a single parent. Sigh. Overwhelmed by confluence, Bobby ultimately suggested I date someone not as busy. I decided to look up confluence and avoid anyone who uses that word. I also realized I need to stop attempting to date dads with young kids.
My guest is Robin Engel, and her book is Woman on the Verge of Paradise, which she describes as memoirish. It is based on her life, and most of it is true, but you do, of course, change people's names.
Yeah.
And maybe take a little artistic license here and there.
A little bit
here
and there.
In the telling of your story. Yeah. You mentioned that the number 18...
Number 13. Oh, the number 18. I'm sorry. 18, yes,
no, 13.
I do.
13, you, 13 keeps coming up.
Yeah.
But I wanted to, something I didn't know about the number 13 in Judaism.
18.
And
you
say you did not number your chapters until you'd finished the book.
It was very
cool. And guess
what? Yeah. It has 18 chapters. And I had told my writing group friends when I was working on the draft that it would be really amazing if my book happens to fall into having 18 chapters. Because it's a very special number in Judaism, and it signifies life and good things and blessings. And so it was really powerful to me. That's the message I wanted to end my book with, is to life and blessings to my readers. And
because just now you thought I was going to ask you about the number 13. That, that keeps coming up in your life, and it's kind of the other side of that coin.
It really is.
And how did the number 13 keep coming up in your life?
And I was never superstitious, Nancy, which is really interesting about it. So I kind of just dismissed it. But after all that I went through with Justin, that the person who is my Prince Charming and was my Prince Charming in life and in the book, he was 13 years older than me. I met him 13 years after I moved from the Bay Area. I mean, to the Bay Area, I'm sorry, from Los Angeles. Our marriage lasted 13 months. Our divorce took 13 months. And I counted my close friends at the wedding, 13. There are probably more 13s I'm not thinking of right now. It's pretty eerie. So I think I need to avoid men who... for whom there's a 13 thing going with me. So, yeah.
Well, it does come up. And so we kind of glossed over the fact that you met this man who was the love of your life.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned, you referred to him as Prince Charming. And on page 93 in your book, Robin, you profile Prince Charming and who else?
Cinderella.
So would you read those two profiles? This is on page 93.
I would love to. This is actually really a big kind of message and core to my story. So how would the world's most perfect couple have described themselves through personal ads had they not met at the ball? I imagine something like this. Name, Cinderella. Sex. Oh, no, not until marriage. Giggling and blushing. Appearance. They say I'm beautiful. Perfect height, weight, figure, and feet. Hobbies. Talking to birds. Playing with mice. Sewing. Cooking and cleaning. Seeking.
Now, sorry. And the seeking, who is Cinderella
seeking? Male. This is really a big point I wanted to make. So much of it doesn't matter. Just a man. Any age, religion, ethnicity, and employment status, criminal and substance abuse history doesn't matter. Relationship history doesn't matter. Kids or no kids doesn't matter. Looks and money, a plus. And first date preference, marriage.
Okay, before you read in the profile of Prince Charming, I wanted to go back to the fact that you say Cinderella, when she's describing her appearance and her hobbies, thought Walt Disney influenced. Her hobbies are talking to birds and playing with mice, sewing, cooking, and cleaning. Those are her hobbies, and she describes the meal that she's looking for. And what about Prince Charming?
Prince Charming. So name, Prince Charming. Sex, please, frequently and often. Appearance, gorgeous, manly, and extremely handsome. Hobbies, waltzing. Seeking, beautiful female, perfect height, weight, figure, and feet. Nothing else matters. First date preferences, family is pressuring me to marry. I just want to get laid.
This is my guest, Robin Engel, reading from her book, Woman on the Verge of Paradise. And she has just profiled this imaginary Cinderella and Prince Charming. And you mentioned that his hobbies are waltzing. And I thought that was interesting because you love to dance.
I love to dance, yeah.
And one of the characters in your book you call Mr. Salsa.
Yeah.
That you met in Chico at Studio One.
And
this is on page 304.
Thank you.
You describe your relationship with Mr. Salsa. Mm-hmm. And what was that like? Yeah, on page 304.
Yeah, it was extremely interesting. Let's see. We'll go to...
Yeah, as dancing wrapped up, I agreed to join Mr. Salsa for a bite to eat.
Yeah, and so Arsenio's was closed at that hour, but the drive-thru was still open, so we picked up tacos. We can eat here, he said, or we can eat at my place. It won't be comfortable in my car. That was likely his plan in the first place. I did want to eat comfortably, not in a car, so I agreed. After finishing some carne asada in his dining room, Mr. Salsa walked me into his garage to show off a few things. First, he introduced me to his cockatiel, then an Amazon parrot, and finally an Asian lovebird. How you doing? How you doing? The birds kept repeating as he kissed their beaks. I felt at once intrigued and nauseous. I stared and chatted a little with the birds, giving them a light touch on the head. Let me show you something else. He then strolled over to some sort of fitness swing trapeze apparatus. Watch this, he boasted. Mr. Salsa plopped onto the swing and then abruptly whirled upside down into a back bend. I had no words. The man popped up and hopped off, moving over to an immense black vat in the corner of the garage. Do you like hot wax? He inquired. The night grew weirder by the second. Say what? Hot wax. Watch. He dipped his left hand into the barrel, apparently full of hot wax. It's good for cuts, see? He pulled his thin zombie-like hand up and proceeded to strip a layer of hot wax off his fingers, one by one.
Well, this sounds strange, but this is not even the strangest of the encounters.
Oh, no,
I mean, you have had a lot of, but this does gets weirder as you describe it. And so, obviously, that relationship didn't last with Mr. Salsa. Mm-hmm. And then you run into this other gentleman who has, because some of them, just in their emails and their texts, they can't spell cat.
They cannot
spell, like, like that thing that you eat, spelling S-T-A-K-E.
Right.
And you wonder about that. But then, what's the guy that wants to tell you jokes? This is on page 311.
Oh, yeah.
And he's telling you these jokes, and you say, no, that's not funny. I'm still not laughing.
Yeah.
And so then what does he say?
So I call him Mr. Ribald. Mr. Ribald tried again, spewing jokes about peacocks and other creatures that walk into a bar. Nope, not funny. Not funny either. I'm still not laughing. Well, you tell a joke, he insisted, befuddled. I don't do one-liners. It's not my kind of humor. Exasperated, Mr. Ribald declared, I think you don't have a sense of humor, so this isn't going to work. I wouldn't have anything to say on our second date, and I feel judged. In Shakespearean manner, Mr. Ribald abruptly and dramatically stood up and began walking out.
So he walks out, and these other people wonder what's going on, and you say, we shook hands and wished each other well. But then when you got home, what did you do?
Then I got home and madly deleted my dating profile from 3 dating sites, outraged that I'd essentially been stood up during a date by a man who claimed I have no sense of humor because I didn't respond to his crude so-called jokes. It felt wonderfully freeing to rid myself of internet dating, at least for the time being. As I shut down my computer, I realized I'd likely step back into that world of cyber dating down the road. If and when I did, though, I'd return refreshed and rebooted. I'll go on just a little bit longer, because there is no Prince Charming. There is no fairy tale. And I was, alas, okay with that.
My guest is Robin Engel, and she's just reading from her book, Woman on the Verge of Paradise. And in that you say, there is no Prince Charming, there is no fairy tale, and I was okay with that.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, you, a few pages earlier in your book, you reach some conclusions that I think all of us, it's food for thought for all of us, when you say, because you talk about your relationship to your dad, because you talked about your mother died when you were quite young.
Yeah.
And then you say, maybe it all goes back to dad, my need for love and acceptance from people who have little to offer.
Right.
And what did you conclude? You say, our subconscious knows much more, our unconscious knows much more than we do.
Yeah.
This is on page 284.
Okay.
And you said you were really naive.
Oh, I'm so naive, I thought. I don't notice anyone's potential to take advantage of me until they already have. I thought Emma was a good choice because she's not a man. My issues were only with men. Not true. My issues were with everyone. Then again, I realized that's not true either. My issues were with only one person, myself.
And then you say, it was time to stop chasing a dream through others.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you conclude?
I needed to give it to myself, to count only on myself to make my life what I want it to be.
My guest is Robin Engel, and she is a poet, a blogger, and now has I almost called it a novel, but it's not, it's creative nonfiction.
Thank you, yeah.
And I was intrigued by the fact that some people have a tough time coming up with one title of their book, and you called yours Woman on the Verge of Paradise, which has that double meaning.
Yeah.
But you also list in your book titles that you might have given your book, and I enjoyed those. What other titles did you consider?
Oh, yeah, there are 13 of them.
Of course, 13.
Right. Dates and Nuts, or Nuts and Dates. That was actually the original title.
So originally you thought you'd call it Dates and Nuts or Nuts and Dates.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Number 2, Celibacy and Suburbia. Dude, Really? Or Why I Keep Duracell in Business? Or number 5, Robin Engel, a West Coast Carrie Bradshaw minus the sex, glam, glitz, and 5,000 square foot closet. Number 6, 50 Shades of Erectile Dysfunction. Number 7, 101 Shades of Anti-Erotica. Number 8, From Birds to Prince Charming. Did Cinderella really get an upgrade? My 9th alternative title, Prince Charming. Richie Rich with a Foot Fetish or a Woman's Dream? Number 10, The Oys of Sex. Number 11, Chico and the Woman. 12, Anti-Robin's Anti-Fairy Tale. And the 13th alternative title of my book is 13.
My guest, Robin Engel, is reading a list of alternative book titles. And, of course, knowing the meaning of the 13, number 13, there are 13 of these. And you also have endnotes because you have vocabulary that people might not be familiar with.
Right. A lot of Yiddish. I love Yiddish, and I threw in some Yiddish terms, which is pretty fun. So, yeah.
And, for example, that's where you, in your end notes, is where you explain the number 18 and its meaning in your life. So when you're reading this, a lot of what the reader is reading, oh, gosh, poor Robin.
Yeah.
But it doesn't end that way.
Right.
It doesn't have a fairy tale ending because you said this is an anti-fairy tale.
Right, right. And it has, I would say it has a fairy tale ending that's very non-traditional.
Yes.
It's my happily ever after that I end up at the place I end up alone. So
Yeah. Alone but okay with that.
Oh, alone but okay with that. Actually, I think I'm happier and just freer and more satisfied than ever. So,
well, thank you for coming in today,
Thank
Robin.
You so much, Nancy. This was a lot of fun.
My guest is Robin Ingle, and her book is Woman on the Verge of Paradise. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.